Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe. This is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today is no exception. We have a great guest all the way from Miami, Florida. Welcome to the show, Matias Darroch.
Thank you so much, Victor. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, great to have you here. Now, you're in a little bit of a non-traditional path, at least from an investor standpoint. You're an architect and doing some very neat projects in Florida. And before we dive into the details, maybe give a little bit of your backstory and how you got to this point in your journey.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So I'm actually originally from Chile, and I came to the U.S. I had many ties because I grew up a couple of years here in Miami. And I came back in 2016 to do some of the real estate business of my family. I had my background in architecture back in Chile. And soon after that, I realized, you know what, I need to get my license. So a couple of years fast forward, I started MIK Architecture in 2020, right before the pandemic. But that helped me a lot to mix these two worlds of real estate development and architecture into one firm that is dedicated to design and help builders and developers mainly make these amazing homes that are more of a contemporary style homes on the bigger scale, more on the high-end scale, and that give amazing return on investments. At least that's what they tell me.
Fascinating. So you're based in Florida, you're building very contemporary homes. What would you say is the differentiator? Maybe is it just design, or are there other amenities that you're adding to the product that make for a differentiated product?
I would say one of the things that we look at the most, especially when we're designing spec homes, is that it has to be flexible. It has to be flexible for anyone who's going to end up buying and using the property, because the main difference between designing a personal house for someone who, you know, wants to live into it and comes to me directly versus designing a house that you want to sell when you have the biggest audience possible to sell it to, is that you need it. You can't know what the other person is going to want or use the space for, like, specifically. You can try to speculate, that's why it's spec homes, but you want to keep it flexible. So I think the main differential, the difference between our architecture is we, of course, always try to keep it simple for the design, for the construction, while not overlooking the design either, and keeping these flexible spaces that can be used, for example, for a guest bedroom, another office, or a gym, a hobby room. We can even work out some of the connections for a future movie room, for example. So there's a couple of things that we can do that is not expensive at all, that is easy to design. But if you don't think it from the beginning, those flexible options, you know, you can't do it, because at some point it's just going to cost you more money.
I've long believed, and we do a fair bit of construction ourselves, and I've long believed that it's important to have conduit, for example, in a home, so that you have that future-proofing for perhaps wiring technologies that aren't even invented yet, that at some point will form part of the life cycle of the house, so that you can accommodate that. Because like you said, it's easy if you're doing it up front, it's difficult to retrofit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And conduits, it's a great way to go. And we also have seen that too. We are in a Miami that is basically getting flooded every time more. And we need generators at some point. Every house is getting some type of generator. So we got the conduit. If you're not ready as a developer or as a builder to provide that with the house, well, let's have them generator ready. You know, that future proof, like you're saying, it's one of the key things we think about also in the design. Generators, solar panels, car chargers, even the space for elevators. You know, you never know when something is going to happen and you can use that space. Some of them put the elevators in because it's better for sale. Others just don't want to put it. So what do you do if we use it as a closet or a utility room on both levels? So it's not a big deal.
Yeah, I love that. One of the things we see certainly in the Miami area, certainly the Florida Keys, is you're so close to sea level that it's important to just take insurance into account. So many of the homes that I've seen almost treat that lower level as sacrificial from the standpoint that if it does flood, there's not going to be an insurance claim on that level. It'll only be on, and in many cases, the living level starts one on the second level. So maybe you put the guest bedrooms downstairs, and maybe you put some other things like the utility room for the pool and things like that, but you really treat it as sacrificial. And if you have to re-drywall it, no big deal. Drywall's cheap.
Right. Well, there is a new code. Well, not that new. It's from 20 something that actually states that you can't put any living areas on the below the flood level. And these, you know, the Keys are particularly special because their flood level is super high, like you said, on the second floor. Like that is where you can start putting living areas. And we have some here in Miami too. And I'm only foreseeing that level is going up. Not only in Miami, but in other parts of the U.S. And what we've been doing with those homes that we encounter that we have to start in that second level is that, well, of course, we have to put the carport because bringing the car up is a bit complicated, a bit expensive. But we do a nice carport or a garage or, like you said, the storage that you don't mind that it gets flooded with, I don't know, some tools here and there. But we also can have outdoor spaces. You know, we can, while we can't sleep in those areas, we can still use them. Pool areas, barbecue areas, lounging, you know, even a hot tub. All of those things can, yeah, they get flooded, they get dirty. You just, you know, clean it afterwards or drywall it up. All of those things help also for getting pretty nice amenities that in another case would just be dirt.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a school of thought that says that, you know, single family homes as an investment are maybe not necessarily the best investment. Even if you're a developer of single family homes, getting the margin in today's market can be challenging. Talk a little bit about your perspective, because you do work with developers. What is it that you do from a value engineering perspective that makes these projects pencil?
Not only I work with developers, I also develop a couple of homes here and there. So pretty there. And one of the key things we've been bad engineering in our homes right now are windows. Windows, impact windows are getting way too expensive. And it's unfortunately, it also affects a bit the design, but the cost difference is incredible. Another great thing about value engineering that we've discovered is the structure itself. So the structure is 30% of the whole, typically 30% of the whole construction budget, between 30 and 40. But when we manage to make it quite efficient in a way that we're using walls on top of the beams and we're not doing too many, we're following a grid, basically. When you're following a grid in the design, you get a bunch of savings. Our goal is to have it at 30%, you know, the minimum range of the whole construction budget. And that, of course, starts with the upfront value engineering. So I think that's the catch here. We don't do value engineering after we've submitted permits. And when we start getting bids, we do the value engineering before we submit to the permits. And that's our goal, you know, to try to get the bidding as soon as possible so that we can figure out what's going to cost us more in the project and try to fix it.
So are some of these techniques using things like, for example, dimensional lumber as opposed to engineered product that's going to be less expensive and limiting your spans between columns to 16 feet and things like that so that you're not having to bring in a lot of structural steel to handle those larger spans?
Well, in our case, we do mainly in Miami, because of the hurricane zones, we do concrete
block. Concrete block,
and concrete block. But the same things applies. You know, when there's a point that the concrete beam is so high that it doesn't look contemporary anymore, so we have to start using steel beams. So we're going to try to look for that midpoint or try to look some other option where the spans don't be so great and work out something that avoids the steel beams.
Yeah, and of course, the most expensive of all choices would be load transfer beams, where you're,
of course.
Right? So you've got situations where you'd really like to have the load transmitted down to a footing and you just can't get there.
Yeah. And the other thing that we had to really take care of, especially in the waterfront properties, where I believe the bigger profits are, is the piles. So in a good design, you can reduce, I'd like to say 20% of the piles that you need versus a design that, you know, didn't think of the piles in first hand. it just went with the design. So I got a project that from another architect that they gave it to me so I could try to value engineer it. And yeah, we just shifted a couple of things here and there, and we'd reduce like 15% of the piles used, which is a big chunk in the end.
Absolutely. Now, one of the challenges, of course, in fact, throughout the entire state of Florida is from a geotechnical standpoint, you have very poor soil stability. You have very few rock quarries where you actually even have access to aggregate materials that you could use to stabilize things. And if you do, you're bringing it in probably by a rail car from Georgia or someplace like that. So, like you said, you're really driving piles down to bedrock. What have you found is the most effective and cost effective? Is this are these soldier piles? Are they wood piles? What's been most effective?
Because of the, I think of the depth we have to achieve 30 plus feet, the most efficient ones is one, typical auger pile, the concrete pile. And that's when you're doing new construction. Now, when you're doing retrofit or flips, many cases you want to open up the spaces, the layout and everything, you have to do a couple more piles. And in that case, we do three or four helical piles near the original pile so we can reinforce that area.
Fascinating. What would you say some of the other differentiators are? So when clients come to you and they're looking for a product, what is it that you do that's perhaps differentiated from the other more commodity product in the marketplace?
I could compare that with multifamilies, residential projects, or other types of single family. What would you like?
Let's start with multifamily.
Sure. So the biggest thing about multifamilies that I still have a couple of them. I'm more of the small scale multifamilies, like 20 units or 30 units. They all have the same issue. Once you go over the threshold of 2 units, the duplex, you get a bunch of additional restrictions from the city, at least in Miami-Dade area. I'm not sure in the rest of the US, but over here in this market, they really give you a hard time trying to get those permits cleared. And that's one thing. And because of that, your time from starting the project to getting the building permit increases almost to a double. Today, we're getting projects with the building permit, single family projects, in 8 to 10 months. In the cases they don't have anything extra. For multifamilies, we're getting a year and a half to 2. I mean, it's getting crazy. And I would say a couple of years ago, we could make it in a year and a bit more. But now they're getting more and more restrictive. They want more and more stuff. The city wants you to basically do the whole street again. So it's also getting more costly. That's one of the main pushbacks that I get. And of course, that all disappears when you're doing a 100-foot, 100-unit multifamily or above, which really doesn't matter that much, but it's still, that's another scale that brings another type of issues. So the single family, I would say the cycle against the multifamily is much shorter. And also you have less investment. So you can, in theory, you could do two or three single families at the same time for the same amount of the multifamilies, but all in a shorter period. And I would say if done right, if get the right opportunity and the right project in place and with all the cost efficiencies, I would say the returns are very similar.
When you say that the time elongates, is this strictly to get a permit that complies with the building code, or are we talking entitlement and building code both together?
No, just the building code. Entitlement would be right, another whole different topic. That also adds to the time. The building code, I'm meaning not the building code itself, because the building reviewers, mechanical, structural, electrical, plumber are pretty fast always. I'm talking about the zoning, the environmental, the public works comments and reviewers, and sometimes we even get planning and board. Which is different than zoning. So there's a couple of other disciplines, a couple of other reviewers that want to get something out of this project because I feel like the cities want that. They want to improve the city at the expense of the developers, not the city itself.
So we're really talking about the site plan approval. You might be building by right according to the zoning, but getting the project approved on that site as a planned use development is where the complexity is.
Right. Yeah, and some cities require that site plan approval beforehand. Some don't, so it also depends on the city. But yeah, that's basically what I was talking about.
Fascinating. Well, Matthias, if folks want to connect, if they want to learn more, what's the best way?
First of all, my website, mikarchitecture.com. That's our firm's website, and over there you can find a lot of contact information, emails, phone numbers. But happy to connect. If you also can look at me in LinkedIn if you want. Matthias de Deutsch. I think I'm the only one there. I think I'm pretty easy to find.
Matthias, love what you're doing. And for the listeners at home, definitely connect with Matthias at mikarchitecture.com. The link will be in the show notes. And in the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.